Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Recognition and Paradigm Shift in Treatment Strategies for Off Fluctuations and Dyskinesia in Parkinson's Disease. I'm Dr. Stuart Isaacson, and I'm the director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center of Boca Raton in Boca Raton, Florida.
And I'm Dr. Rajesh Pawa. I'm a professor of neurology and the director of the Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center at the University of Kansas Medical Center in Kansas City, Kansas.
Today, we will discuss motor fluctuations and dyskinesia associated with Parkinson's disease. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Daniel Cremins. Dr. Cremins is a professor in the Department of Neurology and is a co-director of Movement Disorders Program at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Raja, we speak a lot about Parkinson's disease and how it begins and what causes Parkinson's disease, what we use first line, how do we treat the motor symptoms, but really one of the biggest problems our patients face are the emergence of motor complications, off fluctuations and dyskinesia. Are they really a problem for our patients? Is there still an unmet need to and how do you think about talking to your patients about this? Is it that common?
So one, it's definitely unmet need. I mean, one of the challenges as the disease progresses is our patients getting more and more off time, more and more dyskinesias, and not only that, becoming more and more unpredictable as the time goes on. I personally look in my clinic and I see about 10% of my patients fluctuate every year. So, you know, if I look at it, if they have the disease for 1 year, it'll be about 10%, 2 years, 20%, 10 years, close to 90% of my patients have some degree of fluctuations and dyskinesias. Of course, the challenge comes down to is when are these fluctuations, these off periods and dyskinesias affecting our patients? It will affect them over time, but when do we make that leap in, yes, they're having off time and we need to intervene and do something about it.
So Raj, I agree that it's incredibly common, but I think it's important to point out that among young onset patients, it's even more common. If we take your number, and I think it's true for the general Parkinson's population, where about 50% of people are experiencing motor fluctuations at 5 years. If we look at that same population in the young onset group, it's about 90%. So this is an incredibly common, it's something that every Parkinson's patient is going to experience during the course of their illness.
Yes, thank you. You're right. The younger patients are at a very high risk. And at 5 years, 90% of them are going to have motor complication. And the other thing to remember is the American Academy of Neurology does recommend that we ask our patients at every visit, are they having fluctuations in their medications? Are they having dyskinesias? Because again, it's an important thing to ask and try to manage our patients.
Yeah. I think it's not just younger onset, because if at 5 years a patient doesn't have off fluctuations, I reevaluate the diagnosis. We recently did a series of looking at these patients with DAT scan imaging and found that roughly half of those patients didn't even have Parkinson's disease, that's how common it is to have off fluctuations. Dan, if they're so common, do you have any pearls for how patients, caregivers, and clinicians can better recognize these off fluctuations?
Well, you know, it's a really fascinating question, because if they are so common, why aren't patients coming in and telling us about them, and why are they so hard to recognize? So I think there's a few things. First, people have to understand what is off. Like, we use this language, and a lot of times when we ask patients about this, they actually think we're asking them about compliance with their medicines. So they don't understand what we're actually asking them. So when I talk about off, I use it to mean when medicines fail to give their expected benefit or wear off before the next dose and symptoms return. And that's the language I like to use with patients. So we're all speaking clearly. I had a really interesting situation the other day where a patient wasn't sure whether she was ever off or on because she had tremor that was not levodopa responsive. And that's really common. So I want to educate patients about what they can expect when they take the medicines. And looking at tremor in a patient whose tremor does not respond to levodopa is not a good way to measure whether they're off or on. So again, looking at what symptoms improve when you take your medicines, and then looking at how those symptoms react over the course of the day. And you can do this a number of ways. Sometimes asking patients to keep a diary, like, I took my medicine, in 20 minutes I felt myself turning on, it lasted 5 hours, and then a half an hour before my next dose of oral. And so something like that can be really good. I think something that's really pretty exciting for the future are wearables, right? We're starting to develop these now, and there's some commercial applications for these. But we're pretty poor sometimes, and patients are pretty poor at exactly judging how much they are in fact moving. And the wearables are, particularly as they become more sophisticated, will give us much better data about whether a patient is really off and on and how much they are fluctuating over the course of the day. Go ahead.
And Dan, you know, the thing is also talking to our patients, right? Just asking them. And it starts all the way from the time we start levodopa. If they start levodopa, they have a good response. They are pretty much having on, and that time the on is throughout. And then asking them how their day begins when they wake up. Are they feeling pretty good? Because a lot of our patients have sleep benefit. They take their dose of levodopa. Are they still doing well? Does the medication start working after a while? How long does it take? What happens before the next dose? You know, all these are symptoms that we can gather just talking to our patients too. And, you know, we have patients we struggle with after they are describing it. They're having a hard time describing it. And now with smartphones, at times I just tell them, do a 20-second video and bring it to me. And I can say, looks like they're in, they're off, they're on, having dyskinesias, having tremors. And I think that is something we should make use of it in our patients.
Right. So I saw a patient yesterday in my clinic who said she's feeling very off when she presented. And in fact, she wasn't very off at all. She was too on. She was having a cramping in her feet as a result of probably too much levodopa because she had increased her dose recently. And then these emerged and she thought it was worsening off and kept upping her dose. And that's, you know, that's a very common thing, but I was lucky enough to be able to examine her and demonstrate to her how she really had no bradykinesia. She had absolutely no rigidity. She was able to get in and out of the chairs very quickly. She looked otherwise normal, except for this cramping that was emerging. So, you know, I think it was a variation actually on some form of dyskinesia/dystonia rather than off, but it was hard for her to tell that.
Yeah, I think it's so important to have our patients recognize that these words on and off are not the best words to describe their medical condition. And really, we're talking about when you have benefit from a dose of levodopa, when you're no longer having benefit, that's off. And whether that benefit from each dose of levodopa lasts from dose to dose, or does it wear off too soon, or do you take a dose of medicine, you don't have benefit, that's delayed for a time. It really brings us to thinking about how our understanding of off has changed over the past few years. Dan, you've thought a lot about this. What do you think about what causes off, and how do we now think about it in a perhaps more modern way?
Yeah, so I think, you know, as we're starting to understand and taking a more holistic approach to Parkinson's disease, our understanding of off is becoming a lot better. You know, I think initially we really just thought of off as a central function, right? You had progressive nigrostriatal loss of presynaptic dopaminergic neurons. So the patient would take their levodopa and initially it gets turned into dopamine. They have enough of these presynaptic neurons that can uptake and store the extra dopamine and release it over the course of the day. We call that buffering. And as disease progresses, they lose those presynaptic neurons. They're no longer able to buffer the dopamine, and now they're becoming more and more dependent on the half-life of levodopa, which is relatively short. So a pill that initially was lasting 6 hours or 8 hours is now lasting 4 hours, 3 hours. You're having to increase the medicines from 3 times a day, 4 times a day, 5 times a day. And that's how we were thinking a lot about. But now we have a much greater understanding about the dysfunction of the gut in Parkinson's and the role that that plays in off for people and motor fluctuations. So the vast majority of Parkinson's medicines, including the gold standard levodopa, With the exception of inhaled levodopa, are taken in through the gut. So we depend on this gut, but the gut in Parkinson's disease is dysfunctional, starting right from the mouth, right? So people have swallowing problems, and this can become problematic. And then, well, once it makes it down into the stomach, remember, levodopa can only be absorbed in the first third of the intestine. So it has to get there. But if you have a dysfunctional gut, that pill can just sit in the gut and not ever be, and you know, be digested and not ever get the benefit of getting into the small intestine. And so we think of the different kinds of offs, right? So we think about wearing off, right? That's the traditional one. And that probably is related to the central function of the loss of the presynaptic neurons. But a lot of the other offs are related to the gut. So delayed on. So you take the pill and it just sits there and never gets absorbed. Or dose failures, right? The same thing, probably related to gastroparesis. We have, not full ons or partial ons, probably related to the fact that maybe the levodopa is having to compete with dietary amino acids. And so they both have to go through the same transporter from the gut into the bloodstream. You get this competition, you get similar competition at the blood-brain barrier. And this leads to, you know, partial ons. There's morning off, right? Morning akinesia, the so-called practically defined off state where a patient hasn't had any levodopa from the night before, and now they're waking up and the tank is empty. So understanding that off involves both the central nervous system and the peripheral system, particularly with the gut, can really aid us in how we think about how we're going to treat off.
So, you know, we are getting to two ends, right? You have the off, where people are struggling, their medicine's not lasting, and it all starts with a short half-life of levodopa of about 90 minutes. And on the other hand, you have the dyskinesias, where the pulsatile stimulation of the postsynaptic receptors causing changes in the postsynaptic receptors along with the glutamate receptors overacting are struggling with the dyskinesias. So as we are trying to manage the off, we are struggling in managing the dyskinesias. So Dan, what strategies are we to look at here?
Right, so this is the whole paradox, right? Because if I have a patient who's, so first I think it's important to point out the majority of patients who are experiencing off also have dyskinesia. And I think that that's an important thing to think about because that's going to inform our approach to taking care of the patient, right? It's very unusual. Early on, the patient may just have some off without dyskinesia, but as disease progresses, many patients have both. There are lots of different ways that we can treat off, particularly when dyskinesia isn't present. And so various approaches could be so-called on extenders, right? So the first thing that we could do is we could fractionate the levodopa, we could increase the levodopa dosing, or we could switch the patient to a longer acting form of levodopa. I think it's important to recognize when I talk about longer acting forms of levodopa, I'm really referring to extended release levodopa rather than controlled release or CR. CR is
so could you explain the two with the CR and the extended release?
Right. So CR is an older formulation of levodopa, which is really just a wax matrix that levodopa is crushed and put into. And so it does last longer, but it releases in a very unpredictable, irregular fashion and can be really problematic. For some patients, I'll sometimes use it as an overnight dose where I don't need that predictable response, but I don't like it in most patients as their mainstay of levodopa. Extended release levodopa is a proprietary form of levodopa in capsules where one third of the beads in the capsule are instant release levodopa. And the other two-thirds are a proprietary form of a longer-acting levodopa. So this is a way that you can get predictable release with the instant release. So you get that predictable turning on, but then the levodopa lasts longer through the proprietary longer-acting extended release levodopa. So you can add that on. And so those can be ways that to initially take care of off. But many patients need adjunctive therapies, and there are lots of different adjunctive therapies. The great news is that they all work, and you can tailor in a personalized fashion which one you're going to use based on that patient's particular needs and risk factors. So, for example, you could consider dopamine agonists. Dopamine agonists have been demonstrated in multiple studies for all the different dopamine agonists to decrease off time by about an hour in most studies, some studies a little bit longer. And dopamine agonists work very well for most patients. They're particularly good, I find, for patients who have tremor. They may help with mood issues for some patients, and they can be very helpful for some patients who also have restless legs. The challenge with dopamine agonists is that some patients have difficulty tolerating them, particularly older patients. They can lead to some sleepiness and some hallucinations in older folks. And then we always have to be careful with any medicine that increases dopaminergic tone, but particularly with the dopamine agonists for impulse control disorders. There's COMT inhibition. Catechol-O-methyltransferase is an enzyme in the bloodstream that breaks down levodopa on its way up to the brain. And there are a number of different COMT inhibitors. There's an entacapone, which you will take with each dose of levodopa. It's a short-acting COMT inhibitor. There's tolcapone, which is really not used very much as a practical matter because of some concerns with hepatotoxicity. And there's opicapone, which is a once-daily form of COMT inhibition. And these medicines, again, can work very well to increase levodopa available to the brain. Opicapone raises the serum level of levodopa by about 74% more levodopa presenting to the brain. So these medications can be very effective. And again, they are well tolerated. Some people can get some diarrhea. Some people can get some change in the color of their urine with entacapone. We don't really see this with opicapone. And I mentioned the hepatotoxicity with tolcapone. And the COMT inhibitors, again, can give anywhere between 1 to 2 hours of reduced off time. There's MAO-B inhibitors, right, which again are sort of a nice complement to the COMT inhibitors in the brain. There's MAO-B, which breaks down dopamine. People with Parkinson's need to hold on to their dopamine, both their endogenous and exogenous dopamine that they're getting from their levodopa. So if we inhibit MAO-B, we have more dopamine available. There are non-dopaminergic strategies that we have available now. There's istradefylline, which was approved in Japan in 2013, approved in the US in 2019. And this is a novel drug that targets adenosine A2A receptors. So for reasons that we don't understand, adenosine A2A receptors get upregulated in Parkinson's disease. And these receptors are on the indirect pathway, which you'll remember is the brake pathway in Parkinson's disease. So it's sort of the perfect storm. You're getting upregulation of receptors that are stimulating a brake in a person who is already slow. So istradefylline works by antagonizing those receptors and therefore sort of lifting the brake on the Parkinson's patient. And then more recently, amantadine, DRER, got an indication, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, for dyskinesia, but also more recently for off time. And IR amantadine has never been demonstrated to reduce off time, but amantadine DRER has been demonstrated to reduce off time without worsening dyskinesia. So we have lots and lots of options to think about how we would treat off time. The issue becomes, what do we do when we have dyskinesia present? Because anything that we do that's going to increase dopamine or stimulate dopamine receptors is going to worsen dyskinesia. And it becomes a real balancing act. So when we think about it, the only drug that we can use in a patient who's already experiencing some dyskinesia, who's having off, that won't worsen dyskinesia is amantadine DRER. And so in my practice, in the patients who are experiencing off with dyskinesia, I'm using that first line. patients who have maybe very mild dyskinesia, I think it's reasonable to use one of the other medications, recognizing though that you may worsen dyskinesia. And in many of the studies, one of the top side effects of the on extenders was worsened dyskinesia.
Yeah, you know, you really suggest that there's been a shift in the paradigm in how we approach these motor complications, recognizing that OFF and dyskinesia are really two ends of the same spectrum, that if you double or triple levodopa or add medications, you have dyskinesias emerge in almost all patients who have OFF. And if you lower, you have more OFF and the dyskinesias are abated. And you bring up this idea of gastrointestinal dysmotility, central effects, plasma levels of levodopa. And we have so many different options. Do you begin to think about using some of these adjunctive medications, extended-release formulations of levodopa, based on what you think the mechanism of OFF and dyskinesia are? For instance, if you think a patient has substantial esophageal and gastric dysmotility, you might think about a non-GI absorbed medicine. If they have more problems with transporter competition at the gut level, the blood-brain barrier level, do you begin to think about a non-levodopa option? If you want to keep things in the plasma longer, you begin to think about extended release formulations and COMT inhibitors. And if you're concerned about central effects, you want to think about the non-dopaminergic medications that work on those upregulated adenosine and glutamatergic receptors, MAO inhibitors, dopamine agonists. What do you think, Raj? Do you think this is a new way of thinking about things in that manner? Or what do you go and say, well, they all can help by 2 hours against baseline, and it doesn't matter what we choose? Should we be more personalized or even precision approached now?
No, we definitely need to. I mean, Dan spoke about early morning off, delayed on, wearing off. I mean, all these are now pointing to us that are slightly different mechanism of action. If a patient wakes up in the morning and is taking 2 hours to kick in, you know, just increasing the morning dose of levodopa is often not going to solve that completely. And that time using something like an on-demand therapy where you have shown the data that on an average it takes 45 minutes to kick in for these patients, we can do it with using subcutaneous apomorphine in 10 to 15 minutes. So those are the drugs we should target towards. Dan brought up the issue about people having restless legs along with dystonia. You know, yeah, we would consider using more dopamine
and other non-motor symptoms as well.
Yes, yeah, that's right. But no, I think not only do we have to look at these, yes, a person is having OFF, but when is the OFF happening? You know, what can we do? If gut is an issue, maybe we need to try as much as we can bypassing the gut.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that's really important, and I didn't touch on yet, but is this notion of, you know, I've been focusing more on the on extenders and things like that, but clearly there is, and this really is shifting the paradigm, there is a need for on-demand therapy, and incorporating on-demand therapy into our use of the on extenders or adjunctive therapy. It doesn't have to be an either or, it can be an and situation. So for example, like you just said, Raj, I think the situation with morning akinesia, you know, taking more levodopa, it's probably only going to cause more side effects. It's not going to get the person turned on any faster. And subcutaneous apomorphine has been demonstrated, you know, in the study by Dr. Isaacson to reliably turn patients on in the morning. You know, the other situation is, what if you're having a situation where, you know, you're having relatively predictable offs following lunch, right? Things like that. This is what I think you were talking about, Stu. Like, we have to look at the mechanism, and that mechanism there is almost certainly related to either competition of dietary proteins or delayed gastric emptying with, you know, due to the food in the stomach. And so telling the person to take another levodopa or adding a COMT inhibitor or having them take an MAOB inhibitor isn't going to address that problem. That's somebody who's going to have to take an inhalation of levodopa if they're an appropriate patient, or take an injection of subcutaneous apomorphine. And there's no reason why we can't have patients doing both, right? You're having OFF, fine, let's give you that MEOB inhibitor. Let's give you the COMT inhibitor. Let's give you istradefylline. Let's give you some amantadine, DRER, all of these adjunctive therapies we have. But let's also suggest, but maybe when you're, these might take a little while to be effective for you. We should give you an inhaler of levodopa to have, or get you set up to learn how to do an injection. So, because we know from all these studies and what I've been talking about, you reduce off time with an on extender by about an hour or so. And most of the studies, these patients are coming in with, 5 to 6 hours of off in general. So yeah, you're improving things, but they're still having a lot of off time that needs to be addressed. And the on-demand therapies allow patients to address that. The other thing that we haven't talked about off, because we keep on talking about off, but off is really more about time to on. When you look at what is an off episode, the majority of it isn't actually the wearing off, which the on extenders are good at, it's the time to on. So we really need turning on drugs, and that's what the on-demand therapies really are. And so we can use the adjunctive therapies to address the overall question of off time, but people with off time are still experiencing off episodes, even with the best optimization of their levodopa and their adjunctive therapies. And that's why we need this other tool, which are the on-demand drugs.
We are talking about on-demand therapies, but could you tell the listeners, what do you mean by on-demand therapies?
What I mean by on-demand therapies are therapies that can empower the patient to address an off episode. So off time is that cumulative amount of time that the patient is spending off, but when they have specific episodes where the dose, where their medications fail to turn them on, where they get a dose failure, where they're having that morning akinesia, that's what I think of. And so there are two FDA-approved on-demand therapies in the United States, and those are inhaled levodopa or subcutaneous apomorphine. And they've both been demonstrated to be effective in reducing off episodes.
You know, the non-dopaminergic medications are really something unique. And Dan points out the delayed release, extended release formulation of amantadine and istradefylline, which blocks adenosine 2A receptors. Do you think any particular populations of patients who experience off or with or without dyskinesia, you think about these two medicines in?
Yeah, so to me, if a patient is having off time with dyskinesias, there's only one FDA-approved medication, which is the amantadine DRER taken at bedtime. This should not be confused with the other extended amantadine IRER, which is used in the mornings, which has not been shown to reduce off time, but has been shown to reduce dyskinesia. So today, if I look at a patient, when I know using any other dopaminergic medication to extend their duration of on is going to result in more dyskinesias, I would rather use amantadine DRER, which would help both their off and dyskinesia.
How about istradefylline?
So istradefylline is a unique drug, like Dan explained. It's non-dopaminergic. To me, the advantages are that it doesn't cause some of the dopaminergic side effects of excessive daytime sleepiness. In fact, it may actually cause less sleepiness in studies than placebo, doesn't have as much risk of orthostatic hypertension, cognitive issues, and it still reduces off time by 1 hour to 2 hours. So again, to me, that is a unique drug, and we only have one drug in that class.
Yeah, and we say 1 hour over placebo, 2 hours from baseline.
Correct.
They're all very similar. So Dan, we talked a lot.
In patients who are already taking lots of other adjunctive therapies, and you're still getting that additional hour.
So Dan, we talked a lot about the how prevalent these motor complications are of off fluctuations and dyskinesia, how to recognize them better. We talked about mechanisms and how maybe to take a precision approach and choose our adjunctive medications based on the underlying mechanism. What types of pearls can you offer clinicians and listening in and perhaps even patients and caregivers for deciding when to treat off and dyskinesia in terms of frequency or severity or time of day or impact on daily activities. It's a short visit people have nowadays. Any quick pearls that you could offer?
I think the quick pearls are, first, from the physician side, you got to ask the questions. You got to ask what's happening with the patient, what their day is like, try and get some specific examples. And from the patient side, make notes, tell your physician or your caregiver about your day. And so they have a real sense of how you're doing, because I think patients either don't recognize they're off. Some patients tend to underestimate it because they don't want to admit that their disease is progressing, things like that. So that can be a real challenge. And understand that these things really have impact. I think a lot of times patients start viewing off as just an inevitable part of disease and don't realize it can be treated. We can improve things. You don't have to accept this. And I think from the physician standpoint also, you know, people with Parkinson's disease deserve optimistic physicians and not therapeutic nihilists. So I think we need to embrace these new therapies, explore them, get comfortable with them, particularly, you know, in the United States, on-demand therapies are grossly underused. And there are some barriers to on-demand therapies in terms of that they're specialty pharmacy drugs and there may be costs and things like that. But we should still be advocating for our patients to try and get these newer therapies, because it's allowing them to treat things that I think many people, including physicians, have just sort of given up on. They think, well, we can't do anything about it, and we can.
So we have these on-demand therapies. We have these extended-release formulations of levodopa. We have new COMT inhibitors that are more robust and specific and once daily. We have a lot of medications we can choose from. Raj, we've talked about some new things on the horizon that we're excited about. What are you excited about that's on the horizon to treat motor?
Right. But I think even before we go there, I know we don't have enough time today, but we also need to keep in mind we have surgical options, deep brain stimulation. We have focused ultrasound, which also help motor fluctuation dyskinesias, but unfortunately, we are not going to be able to cover that. But, you know, the future is there are newer dopamine agonists that are being looked at to help with reducing off time.
D1 specific agonists that don't have the side effects Dan pointed out.
That's correct. You know, we're going to have stem cells available in the future. So I think
gene therapies.
That's right.
The thing I'm most excited about that we actually may see in the relatively near future are pumps, right? We may have levodopa and apomorphine pumps available.
Subcutaneous.
Bypass the gut without a surgery to insert a tube, for example.
Yeah. And these are similar to an insulin pump diabetics wear that are put on subcutaneously and are worn and can help reduce both off and dyskinesia over time. And we have new long-acting forms of levodopa that'll hopefully become available. I think in the next year, we're probably going to see the FDA approval of 3 subcutaneous pumps and a new extended-release formulation of levodopa. So lots of new things coming that I think provides optimism for us and hopefully for our patients and their caregivers.
Yeah, it's why I have this rainbow in my slides, dude. This is my background, because again, I think we need to be optimistic for our patients, and it's an exciting time to be a Parkinson's doctor. And I think in the next year, hopefully these things make it to market and our patients get to benefit from them.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us, Dan. It's been great hearing all your insights. Raj, before we close, any advice you'd like to share with our listeners and clinicians on managing Parkinson's disease off fluctuations and dyskinesia?
Right. So I think we need to ask our patients if they're having off time. We need to pay attention if they're having any dyskinesias when they come to the clinic. We need to ask them when the offs are happening so we can target the drugs, whether it's a slow kick in, whether it's wearing off. And we need to see that there are still patients who are struggling because we, as physicians, may not be paying enough time in talking to them about their off and dyskinesias.
And I think with that type of advice, coupled with medications, both dopaminergic and non-dopaminergic, that work centrally, ways to enhance plasma levodopa, now and in the future, and ways of bypassing the gastric dysmotility and in protein transporter competition with on-demand therapies. I think the future is probably going to be encouraging for our patients. So thank you all for joining us today, and it's great talking with both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
We discussed with Dr. Kremins the explosion of motor therapies, and really began to link that to the pathophysiology of the underlying mechanisms of different types of motor complications. And we touched on dyskinesia and off fluctuations and all, and really highlighted that from the laryngeal-pharyngeal border down to the anal-rectal border, there's GI dysmotility. And the dysmotility in the esophagus and the stomach leads to a delay in delivery and a delay in onset, protein competition in the gut-lumen border and the blood-brain barrier. With protein competition can delay and reduce the optimal benefit, leading to suboptimal on and delayed on. How not having a continuous presence of levodopa in the plasma can shorten the duration of benefit of each individual dose based on the short half-life of IR levodopa and the role of different medications. And then in the brain centrally, the dopaminergic and non-dopaminergic strategies of trying to treat these. How impactful is that to clinical practice in your center in thinking about how to choose medications?
Yeah, I think, one of the important points that he brought up is all offs are not the same. Mm-hmm. We have an early morning off, we have a wearing off, we have a delayed on. Wearing off is not purely wearing off, it's also wearing off and the delayed on that occurs later. How often our patient tells us, oh, we wait to take the next dose until I'm off. Well, their on may take them an hour to get back on. So all those are important things. I think he brought up the point about using on-demand therapies or treating the off and giving patient that control, that they can decide, well, I wake up in the morning and it's taking me an hour to kick in. Well, maybe I should use subcutaneous epimorphine and start working in 15 minutes. Maybe during the day when I start turning a little bit off before the next dose, I could inhale some levodopa and be on until my next dose. So I think that was one important thing, is using on-demand therapies, especially for early morning akinesia, as well as for delayed on during the day. And the other thing is, because these on-demand therapies are not going through the stomach, we can pretty much also use it in patients who have delayed gastric emptying, where it is, again, taking a while to get them going. The other important point he brought up is we were always struggling in adding medication to help with the off, and the prize was the dyskinesias. And now for the first time, we have approved drug like amantadine DRER given at bedtime, which helps not only the off time, but also the dyskinesias. So I think those were a couple of important things that were takeaways from his part.
And we have the non-dopaminergic other medication, estradefylline, when patients have dopaminergic side effects. And we have in development the D1 specific agonist when they have D2 side effects. It's really moving to a very more designer drug in a sense. We've had such advances in diagnosis with the SYN1 test and DAT scan and gene testing. We mentioned the excitement of possibly having a seed assay, not just in spinal fluid like we have now, but hopefully in the blood, in FDA-approved blood in the next year. Right. And with non-motor symptoms, having new therapies directed specifically at other non-motor symptoms, new antipsychotics and the medications for daytime sleepiness and drugs that are being tested for dementia and Parkinson's, and all these new motor therapies of subcutaneous infusions that are coming next year, and longer acting oral extended release formulations. But how about trying to actually slow down the underlying disease process in Parkinson's? We've been involved in a lot of clinical trials, and we've been met with not finding the difference between placebo, but what are you excited about in trying to slow disease progression? What types of studies are going on that you think might hopefully pass muster? Yeah.
I think, we don't have a drug to slow Parkinson's disease is not because of lack of trying. We have tried really hard for the past 30 years in trying to find something that we could, if not cure, at least slow Parkinson's disease. Part of it is also related to not having a clear-cut idea, is all Parkinson's the same or not? Or is it, you know, in certain cases, we are targeting antisynuclein therapies. In certain cases, we are looking at other anti-inflammatory therapies. So all of these now are, we are looking at a specific reason of using it. You know, we have some very early data on some of the antisynuclein therapies showing that after 4 years, there would be a difference if the patient had taken the drug versus not taken the drug. So I think the Roche antisynuclein antibody really did bring up that part of the reason is we are trying to get answers in 6 months, 1 year, with the lack of true biomarkers, it's taking us longer to see those results. And I'm very hopeful as we have better biomarkers, we'll be able to answer that question in a shorter time, like 1 year, that this is indeed happening or not. The challenge is still going to be, is a change in biomarkers going to be enough for the FDA to say, okay, you showed that, yes, you are changing the clinical progression, or they're also going to need a clinical biomarker, which would mean that it's going to be much longer before we can get there.
And we should have results in 2024 for exenatides, for GBA mutations, next year for LRRK2 inhibitors. And remarkably, we're about to start enrolling in trials for gene therapies to deliver genes by AAV vector, and for stem cells to be placed into the brain either at the end of 2023 or the beginning of 2024. So I think we're on the verge, hopefully, of studying things that may ultimately represent breakthroughs for our patients.
Definitely. And I would say it'd be 24 because we are pretty close to the end of 2023.